So thank you very much for coming this afternoon. Thank you particularly for the invitation to talk to you. I believe I'm talking on publishing in journals and the strategies that you might choose to adopt for publishing in journals. I think I've got probably five different things to say, which I've got written down in front of me here in relation to five different questions. Why, when, where, what, and how? So let me just spend a few minutes running through those. This is background more than anything else. I'm sure that this session will work best when it becomes interactive. So I'm going to try my very hardest not to talk for any more than the next 20 minutes, which hopefully will leave more than half an hour then for you to be able to ask me some things that I may or may not know the answer to, but like a good academic, I'll pretend I do anyway and tell you something in return. Okay, the why questions. Why might it be the case that you would be interested in having any of your work published in journals? Well, when I was thinking about this on the train first thing this morning, I came up with six answers. And I'm sure some of them are probably better answers than the others. The first one, that I think it proves to your friends and your family that what you're doing is actually proper work, if they get concerned about those sorts of things. This might be particularly useful when trying to bat away the question about being still a student. I'm sure that everyone's had at least one of those moments. I certainly used to. Secondly, and I think this is much more important, it allows you to enter into the dialogue that's had between people who are also specialists in the area that you work. Now, everyone will get to some stage within their PhD and be absolutely convinced. This is a big epiphanal moment. So if you haven't had it yet, it's coming. Don't worry, you'll get there. That they get absolutely convinced that they do have something really serious to say. And not only that they have something really serious to say, but that it should be said, because the other people working in their field really aren't saying the sorts of things that they do. Now, one of my jobs with the first years is to try to tease this way of thinking out of you, which is why I bang on so often about things like originality and contribution to the literature. It's about getting you into the mindset of believing that you have something that's valid to say, that's going to be a proper contribution to academic debates. And as soon as that notion materialises in your mind, I think it becomes time to put it to the test and see whether you can get anything published in journals. Thirdly, the whole process is about professional socialisation and professional prestige building. This is the sort of thing that academics do routinely, and I would really encourage you to think of yourselves less as students and more as academics, and start to do the things that we have to do simply as a matter of course. So this is the way that we operate. This is what we do. This is our job. We write things and we publish them. Well, it's one part of the job, but a very important one nonetheless. Fourthly, there's an important element of testing out your arguments when you send something off to a journal. Even if you don't get the work published within that journal, it's almost certain that you'll get some very good reviewers' comments on it. If you do get it published in that journal, that will stand you in hugely good stead for the rest of your PhD process. It is a much more exacting form of peer review to have your work looked at by anonymous reviewers for journals than it is to have it looked at by PhD examiners. If you are capable of getting your work past journal reviewers, you will absolutely definitely get your work past your PhD examiners. And don't worry about whether that relationship holds in reverse, because it doesn't. The two levels of peer review are so dissimilar to one another that the level that's expected for journal publications is so much higher that it doesn't mean that if unfortunately you don't get your work past journal reviewers, that it also won't get past PhD examiners. But it gives you such a shot in the arm, such a fillip, such a boost to your self-confidence if you do get something published, that's one very good reason to be contemplating it. Fifthly, I think it also helps you to stake a claim in relation to the academic job market. Presuming that you are interested in using your PhD as a springboard into an academic career, there are certain things that anyone and everyone who's trying to land an academic post now has to have on their research CVs. Sorry, but journal publications is the top one there. The journal publications really rank higher than even the PhD itself when approaching potential employers. And sixthly, I've written this down as REF compliance. So the research excellence framework, which hangs like the sword of Damocles over everyone that works in the UK, has become part of our professional self-understanding. One of the ways in which people try to differentiate themselves now, whether explicitly and deliberately or implicitly and almost subconsciously, is through their REF compliance. What would they be able to present to the profession as a whole as their individual contribution to the research excellence framework? You'll probably find yourself accidentally beginning to incorporate this language as part of the broader academic socialisation of just being around the corridors here. Because this is the way that we, I think, regrettably, have ended up talking to one another within the profession, and that, of course, filters down. So those are my six reasons, and I think they probably became more instrumental the more that I ran through them. I think it would be unfortunate, though, if I left you with the impression that publishing your work is a purely instrumental experience. It's not. The exercise is much broader than that. You will get many more things out of it in terms of your own development as an academic by engaging actively with the publication process. And I would really want to recommend it for those purposes and not for the more instrumental ones that I've listed. Okay, so that's the why. What about the when? When should you start thinking about writing things for publication? Well, clearly, I think you need a good basis of research behind you before beginning. That the demands from journals, the demands from journal reviewers are really quite exacting. So you can't just have a thought one day, write that thought up tomorrow, send it away and expect to be published. There needs to be proper research underpinning the argument that you're trying to write up. And because there needs to be that proper research, it takes time to develop. So I think that there is likely to be a point during the PhD process when you think you've got that body of work behind you that you might then be able to turn into potential publications. But don't expect yourself to be in that position immediately. It does take time. However, having said that, I think it's also difficult to say that it's ever too early to start thinking about journal publications, simply because the type of research that you're likely to be undertaking might change slightly if you're focused on more than one goal at the same time. So the PhD obviously has to be a major goal of your time on the PhD programme. That's why it's called a PhD programme in the first place. But alongside that, there are those other goals, notably publications, I think, that really should come into your calculations at some stage, especially if you have aspirations to build an academic career on the back of your PhD experience. And in those circumstances, I don't think it's ever too early to really start properly thinking about how you might begin to write for journals. This is a change, I think, in the mindset towards supervision. When I started at Warwick, and it's not all that long ago, it's only 6 years ago, the PhD programme was a much more gloomy affair than it is today. And I think one of the reasons was because there really was no programmatic feel to the experience of being a PhD student within PACE. You were told that you had one responsibility, that was to write your PhD as quickly as possible, graduate, say thank you very much to the department, and then bugger off. And I think that was a really unfortunate reflection of the lack of proper incorporation of the PhD students into the department. We're much better than that now. And I think that that's also reflected in a change of attitude towards supervision. When I came here, it was standard for pretty much all PhD supervisors in the department to warn their PhD students against trying to write anything for publication. Those are all the sorts of things that you should do only once you've finished your PhD. That was the message. I don't think that was very good advice then. I think as the academic job market has changed, it becomes progressively worse advice. And I think that if you are interested in an academic career, then it is necessary to think about trying to build a well-rounded research CV that includes publications at the same time as writing your PhDs. Obviously, I'm aware of the implications of saying that. Quite clearly, it comes with an additional set of demands upon your time and an additional set of commitments that you might have to juggle all at the same time. This makes your life more difficult, but at the same time, there would be little point me running a professional socialisation session and then not being honest with you about exactly what the job market looks like and how important journal publications are to that. The second aspect of the when question is just to let you know that there's a significant time lag in the publication process. If you think of how long it takes between first having your wonderful idea about what your equally wonderful journal article is going to look like, writing it up, going through endless bits of the review process, having it accepted, and then finally seeing it in print, it's going to be at least 2 years, I would imagine, from start to finish. Yesterday, I found in my pigeonhole a journal with a piece of work in it of mine, which was nice. And I remember first giving that paper, I think in March 2011. So that's taken less than 2 years, and I was really surprised to see it out in print quite so quickly. So there are often significant time lags. Pieces of work can be in the from the initial gestation period to being formally out in print. It's often the case now that that takes actually significantly over 2 years. So if you imagine what that means in terms of the life of a PhD program, it's a considerable element of the time that you're actually going to spend here. Things are not quite as bad as they might seem on first hearing, though, because a piece doesn't have to be formally out in the printed version and available in hard copy, so you can wave the actual physical journal around and say, look at my piece of work, look at my piece of work. It doesn't have to be like that before you can count it as being a bona fide official publication. Almost all journals now, and this is a very recent development, only really over the last 3 or 4 years, all journals now are moving towards publishing things online first. So they'll have their own unique DOI. I can never remember what DOI stands for. It's something that sounds a bit technological, so obviously I have no idea whatsoever. But a DOI means that it has this unique presence as a published piece of work, even if it's only published in online form beforehand. And it can be published online anything up to a year before it actually sees light of day in the physical journal. And maybe this bit of the story gets even better for you thinking ahead towards trying to access the academic labour market, that even having the emailed confirmation from a journal editor that your piece is now formally accepted, that would be treated by any interview panel, by any shortlisting panel, as guaranteed confirmation that this piece will see the light of day in the formally published print version. So that almost counts as the publication date, even though nobody will be able to see it quite at that time just yet. Now the where questions. Where should you think about publishing? Two comments here, both about hierarchies. There are hierarchies in the type of publication that you might be looking at. In all instances, peer-reviewed is better than non-peer-reviewed for career-building purposes. So some journals are not peer-reviewed, but only very, very few. Most book chapters are not peer-reviewed. Some will be, but again, that's the minority. To do yourself the biggest favour in terms of building your CV up, please do take your time to check in the first instance whether your target outlet is peer-reviewed or not. And you should be advised in all circumstances to try and focus on the peer-reviewed publications rather than the non-peer-reviewed. That is how you gain additional academic professional credibility. So if that's what publication is about, or if that's what one element of publication is about, building that professional prestige, then you really do have to be focusing, if at all possible, on peer-reviewed rather than non-peer-reviewed. Secondly, even within peer-reviewed publications, think of the journals, there are hierarchies. And there are hierarchies understood probably in one of two different ways. Firstly, there are now almost a surfeit of quantitative measures of how good a journal is meant to be. Most professional associations, think the American Political Science Association, for instance, they have journal rankings. They're not purely objective, obviously, but they matter. And they matter because they're an indication of what the people who define what the outer boundaries of the discipline are. It tells you what they think the best journals are. So the APSA, for instance, brackets journals into A, B, C, D. And so the best journals, in their view, are A, the next lot are B, and so on and so on. There are even more fine-tuned distinctions, though, through journal impact factor ratings. I had no idea what an impact factor rating was until very, very recently. I still don't know exactly how they're arrived at, but what I do know is that as soon as you put a number on a journal, it's easy to then produce a rank ordering. So the supposedly best journals, guess what? They have the higher impact factor ratings. You will find a journal's impact factor rating on the first page of their website. Not all of them have been around for long enough to have qualified for a journal impact factor rating as yet, but a lot of the more established ones, in fact all of the more established ones, do. Now, we did a bit of number crunching as a department after the last REE exercise to see where, on average, we thought that the REE panel was drawing the dividing line between a three-star and a four-star piece of work. This is REF language again. Three-star meaning internationally recognised, four-star meaning world-leading. And you not only are able to pat yourself on the back if anyone believes that your work is four-star, it massively improves the leverage that you have within the academic labour market. And we thought at that time that the average decision made by the REE panel would have placed the boundary between three-star and four-star in crude journal impact factor rating terms somewhere between 0.9 and 1. Any journal in our subject field that has an impact factor rating greater than 1 is treated as being a very, very serious place to have your work published. It's rather different in science. So if you have any friends who are proper scientists and who do proper scientific work, they might tell you about Nature, which I believe in last recording has a journal impact factor rating of 27 point something. And so you tell them about this wonderful publication you've got in a politics or a sociology journal that's 1.6, and you're hugely proud of that, and they fall over laughing at you. So if you've ever had reason to think in inferiority complex terms when talking to proper scientists, do not engage them at any level in discussions about journal impact factor ratings, because it's a discussion you can do nothing other than lose, and lose hands down. I've actually always thought, this might be me being old-fashioned though, that the qualitative indicators are more important than the quantitative ones. But even I have to keep my eye on the quantitative ones these days. If for no other reason, then I'm required as part of my job to advise colleagues, more junior colleagues along those lines, so it would be a bit hypocritical if I took no notice of it at all. I still think the qualitative measures are the more important ones though, and that's just knowing your part of the subject field and knowing where people that you respect publish their work and incorporating those same sorts of assumptions. So publishing in a particular journal or a particular set of journals will tell you something about the company that you keep And if you try to keep the company of where the people that you properly, genuinely respect as academics are doing their publishing, then I think that that will give you a better sense of self-confidence than simply trying to take note of journal impact factor ratings. Okay, let me move on because my time's getting short. So the what question. So what is a journal article? What's it look like? Well, firstly, in general, it will be between 8 and 10,000 words. Those tend to be the two limiters that journals place on publications. In the old days, we were told that it used to be around 8,000 words and everyone took liberties. And we were allowed to take liberties because of the way that we used to submit things for assessment. You had to print it out, you had to photocopy multiple copies, and by the time you actually submitted something, the whole pack of stuff was about that thick. So it cost an absolute fortune in postage. Now, however, all journals have online submissions, and those online submissions can check immediately exactly how long your pieces of work are. So the self-declared paper submissions, where it was really 13,000 words, but you said, oh, it's 8,000. You can't do that anymore. If it's any more than the limit, then the online submission process will actually reject it in the first instance. It just won't let you submit it. So you've got to take those word constraints seriously. Secondly, in terms of the what should it look like? Well, it needs to be a standalone piece in its own right. So it has to have its own defined beginning, middle, and end. Now, this can sometimes be quite difficult, especially if you're thinking of trying to present the argument of the whole of your PhD in journal form. Actually, I would advise you against that because I just think it's almost impossible to be able to do that. As a reviewer, and I've reviewed endless pieces for endless journals over the years, it really does stick out like a sore thumb when somebody's taken a very big piece of work and tried to rewrite the whole of that very big piece of work as 8,000 words. And that applies just as much to the most senior member of the profession who's trying to condense their book into a single article form as it does to somebody who's trying to do the same thing with their PhD. In both instances, it just looks wrong. There's too much going on for a single 8,000 word piece of work. So I think what you need to do is think very carefully about how your PhDs divide into separate little arguments and organise your journal writing around those separate little arguments, which in the process of writing them up obviously will become bigger arguments, but not such a big argument that it contains the whole of your PhD as a whole. Guess what, first years? Guess what I'm going to say here? It needs to be able to show that it constitutes an independent contribution to the literature in its own right. And so the language that you would use when setting your article up is exactly the same as the language that I've been encouraging you to think about using during all of the sessions that we have on the first year training module. So make sure that it coheres in its own right by being a standalone piece that doesn't need to be read in relation to any other bits of your work. So a journal article is not just a simple reworking of a PhD chapter, because a PhD chapter can refer forwards and backwards to other parts of the PhD thesis. A journal article doesn't have the liberty of being able to do that. So yes, there are some good time-saving devices that you can employ by using a PhD chapter as the basis for a journal article, but the two things are not formally identical. The journal article must be able to stand on its own in a way that a PhD chapter doesn't, because the PhD chapter is part of a bigger piece of work. Okay, finally, the how questions. How do you go about choosing an argument to run with, and how do you go about putting that argument into an article form? Well, firstly, I think the issue here is of targeting. Make sure that you can target a narrow narrow is probably the wrong word, but target a tightly defined argument, and also make sure that that argument is likely to be received sympathetically at the journal to which you're writing for. So I think my advice is that it should come that way round. Know your own intended argument first, and then work out what sort of journal would be suitable for sending that argument to. Secondly, there's some extra work here for your supervisors. Your supervisors should be helping you not only to formulate the argument for your journal article, but also through reading drafts of it. And I think it's very important that supervisors do take on that more extended role. It isn't just your PhD that they're attempting to supervise. They should be attempting to give you as much help as possible in doing those other things that might also end up on your well-rounded research CVs. Also use one another. You can get some really good comments from one another. Not only comments in terms of content, but also comments in terms of structure. Everyone in the room now will have read so many journal articles already within their career that you know what a journal article looks like. And so you'll be able to tell your friends and your colleagues on the programme whether what they've just shown to you actually does look as though it exhibits the sorts of features that you would expect from a journal article. Thirdly, then it becomes time to submit it to the journal. And the first thing that you have to do is hope that it passes the initial checks run at the desk. In the last 2 or 3 years, a new phenomenon has arisen within journal publication called the desk rejection. And desk rejections can happen for all sorts of reasons, but usually because somebody sitting on the desk at that time has decided that your work doesn't fit the scope of their journal. You might not agree at all. This happened to me only last week. So I'd spent my time getting a piece of work off, and they said, thank you very much, but it doesn't fit here. That actually happens to me quite a lot, which probably says something about the type of research that I try to do. But if you do get past the desk check stage, and don't worry if you don't, because that only places you in company with me, and it's not all that bad being over here on this side of the desk, then it gets sent to the reviewers. And the reviewers are clearly the most important people here. It will be they that pass judgment on the suitability of your work. It will go into an anonymous peer review process. So you don't get to know who the reviewers are, but equally the reviewers don't get to know who you are. And you're required to do all that you can to disguise your identity in the written piece of work that you submit. So no putting your name all over it, in other words. Some people that I know, some people very high up in the profession, have the awful tendency to slip in the line, as I have elsewhere argued, and then introduce a quote from their own work. Terrible, terrible, terrible form, that is. Please don't do anything like that at all. Make it a proper anonymous process. And once the reviewers have decided, the editors will look at what the overall recommendation is. And if the reviewers are split, you won't know this at the time, but they're more than likely to go and find other reviewers to see whether a second lot of reviewers will break the tie in the recommendation. So only after the editors think that they have a clear steer from the reviewers do you get the decision. And the decision is likely to be one of four things these days. Accept as is, that happens hardly ever. And when it's happened to me, I've actually regretted that, because there are always things that you can learn in terms of increasing the clarity of your own argument from the things that reviewers criticise you for. So I guess you never turn down an accept as is, but at the same time, you'd rather have been told the things that were a bit wrong with it that could be ironed out before you give them your final version. The second one is accept with minor revisions. And minor revisions can actually be quite demanding from time to time. And if you get an accept with minor revisions, you do the revisions and you do them as well as you can and you do them in the way that the reviewers and the editors have told you to do them, even if you're not 100% sure that if left alone, that's what you would have chosen to do. And you do that because you're so close to then getting a very important publication on your academic CV that it makes no sense to start playing silly buggers and refusing to do it. I have had PhD students of my own in the past. Probably my most problematic ones have been the ones that simply wouldn't take any guidance from reviewers and editors at all, and who have refused to do minor revisions and have taken the attitude, well, if you don't want it the first time round, I'm not playing anymore. That's why I've got so little hair left now. It's from ripping it out when being faced with PhD students with that attitude. The third one, and by far the most common one, is a revise and resubmit. That the intrinsic worth of what you're trying to do has been noted, has been accepted by all of the reviewers, but they're really not sure that what you've done is the right way to have done it. And I think, once again, if you get a revise and resubmit, firstly, you should be pleased. I treat everything that's not a straightforward rejection as a sign of success, and it's the only attitude to have. You've got to be pleased that you're still in the game, because there are so many ways that you can get chucked out of the game. There are so many stages where you can be told no thank you, that to still be in it and to still have a chance of finally being published in that particular journal, you should accept all of those opportunities that are given to you. So the revise and resubmit is exactly what it says. The only slight difference is that accept with minor revisions doesn't go back to the reviewers. It'll just be the editors who take the decision on whether you've done the revisions properly. But a revise and resubmit goes back to the reviewers, and in effect you start again from there. However, if you show them that you've done everything that they have asked you to do, it then becomes very difficult as a reviewer to still find things to quibble about. So one of the important things that you can do at the revise and resubmit stage is make it absolutely clear just how much you've changed your article on the grounds of what the reviewers were asking you to do. I've been known to write huge documents listing all the changes that were asked and showing exactly how I've done it and how it incorporates into the overall running of the argument. And I do that for a reason. If you can convince them that you've done everything that you asked to do, you'll get an easy time with the second review. So that's what you should be doing. And the fourth possible decision is a straightforward rejection, at which stage I think you take the reviewer's comments seriously, when those comments are constructive in any case, and you just try again. You go and target another journal after you've done another round of revisions. You will find out what the decision is in an editor's letter. Please don't quarrel with editors. Some people think that all they've got to do is send a sharply worded email and editors will turn around and say, oh yeah, actually, you're right. We were wrong all along. It's not our decision as to what goes in to our journal. Thank you very much for clearing this up for us. You'll be the first one in the next edition. It doesn't work like that for very obvious reasons. So please don't do anything to antagonise editors. It really isn't a very good decision at any level whatsoever. You don't want that sort of reputation. Because one thing that you've probably already noticed about our profession is that it's really quite small and really quite gossipy. So don't get yourself a reputation like that. And in terms of responding to or how to read reviewers' comments, I think my main piece of advice is, this is the last thing I'll say, Lauren, sorry I've gone over time, is to don't get too disheartened. Most reviewers will focus merely on making constructive criticisms. Some might hide behind the cloak of the anonymity and say things that they probably wouldn't say directly to your face if they were forced to relay the news like that. But that's the minority of reviewers. I think most reviewers take on the task because they know that it's important. It's an important professional duty. It's important for helping the profession to mature. We always do it in our spare time because it can never be loaded into our normal working days. So there's always pressure on time on reviewers. And it might be that if you feel that you've been unfairly treated or the language is a little bit harsh, it might just be that, that they were doing this on a Saturday morning when they'd rather be having the weekend off because it simply didn't fit in anywhere else in their week. But there are some funny stories about the things that people have been told. And one of the things that I've noticed as well is that it gets easier to ride with the punches the more established you are. I actually quite like some of the really horrible reviews I get because they stick in my mind more than anything else. The very last one I had, which was 3 weeks ago, and I had to look this up because I actually didn't know what it meant, was that one of the reviewers had described my work as mere scholasticism. And my first thought was, well, actually, a lad from the wrong side of the tracks like me to be accused of scholasticism, well done me. But I didn't know what it meant. But it didn't look as though it was a compliment. And I'm not sure I know what it means now, but I'm still sure that it's probably not a compliment. One of my mates from my previous job, he had a wonderful one. The reviewer said something along the lines of, well, I read the abstract, assuming that it was going to be a dull and uninformative article. I then read the next two pages, and I refused to read any more because it went beyond being dull and uninformative, and it just became offensive. And he was established, he got it published somewhere else, he just thought that's funny. And one of the things that academics sometimes do is discuss with one another who's had the worst or the funniest review. It's one of the ways that we prove that we're not dull and uninteresting, I think. Another one of my colleagues had a great one, which was, how on earth has this person tried to write this piece without referencing the work of David Dolovitz? It's clear that Dolovitz is the signal reference here, and that if you don't understand that, then you have no right to be publishing in this field. This was written back to Dave Dolovitz, of course. I had one, a piece of work that I'd written with the bloke who's now chair of our ref subpanel, which started off that this is a passable but not particularly good outline of the well-known Hay and Watson position. So these things are funny, really. And you have to treat all things that reviewers say with a pinch of salt. So even if the language gets a bit intemperate, ignore that and look for the advice, because the advice will be good even if the way in which it's delivered is not very good. And it is much easier, I admit this, it's much easier for someone like me to receive these things and just treat them as a bit of a laugh. Please don't get too disheartened if your first experience of going through the peer review process is not a particularly good one. Because there are so many examples of having a piece rejected in one place but then accepted somewhere else. I remember one of our former PhD students who graduated only a couple of years ago. He had a piece of work that he sent off to Millennium, the journal that you'll probably know is edited by PhD students down at the LSE, that got a straightforward rejection on the grounds of it being no good. He then sent it without doing any more work to it at all to International Political Sociology, a top 10 journal that's sponsored by the International Studies Association. And he got it accepted there without any revisions whatsoever. So strange decisions can take place across different journals. My colleague Nick Vaughan Williams, has this wonderful notion of the Marmite article. The Marmite article that just completely divides reviewers. Some people love it, some people hate it. Those pieces of work usually see the light of day eventually. I've had one, that it was the third time, lucky for me, and the first twice it just divided the reviewers completely to extremes. And I think that the best pair of comments that I had were the approving one, said that the profession has been waiting for 20-odd years for someone to say something this interesting about this particular topic. And the other one said, there's nothing in here that needs saying. And that was it. And so when that happens, editors aren't going to let it through. But then it's the courage of your convictions as to which one's right. And I suppose we all probably want to believe that the positive person is right. OK, I've gone on for far too long, but those are my initial comments. But they're mainly for background purposes. Does anyone want to ask me anything either about that or anything more specifically?
Yeah, I have two questions actually. One is, in other countries besides UK, often PhDs, you have a change in how PhDs are done in an other era, as a lot of people talk more about PhD, you know, it's more about journals, as you mentioned, and so on, journal articles. In other countries, this focus shifts a bit more apparently in terms of PhD. We get focused more on journal publications and then, as well as speaking, also the PhD. While here is a bit more like do the PhD, and if you have some time left, do the journal articles as well. And if I see a lot of people, I know somebody, for instance, from the University of Kent, and he's publishing many articles, and then rewriting the PhD. And I was not sure how it would work here if you, for instance, publish an article, and then write your PhD, and in the end, you submit your PhD, and maybe after a year or something, you want to make a book out of it, in terms of copyrights, because I guess can't just reuse the whole thing to submit a PhD and perhaps the book afterwards if you already published it, because copyrights are with the journal. So not that I'm already having such luxurious problems, I was just wondering to know in advance, if you publish an article, what do you give up for later actually? I'll stop with my first question there.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think you have to be careful not to transgress those copyright borderlines too obviously. One of the things that you might notice when you open books, though, is the acknowledgements at the beginning. And often it will say, and chapter 3 of this book appeared in a different version as an article in this journal. And you would then have to agree with the journal how you were going to resolve those copyright issues. Because it's absolutely true that you are no longer the copyright holder of your own work as soon as it's accepted for publication by a journal. You have to sign those copyrights over to the journal.
So it's a matter of liaising with them?
It is, yeah. So I think in general terms, it's not a huge problem to assume that a piece of work that you'd had published as a journal article, which then gets rewritten in a different form in your PhD and in a different form again for the book that might come out of the PhD. I don't think there's a massive or an insurmountable problem in copyright terms there. I'm not even sure there's a big professional problem, but you do have to be careful at the margins. And one of the things here is, I'm sorry to say it once again, the REF, the Research Excellence Framework, because it does have quite strict rules about no duplications between different pieces of work. And so there, if you're trying to submit a journal article which also appears in a different form as a chapter in the book, officially you have to declare that and ask for all the rest of the book to be reviewed, but not that chapter, which is which is bonkers. But those are the rules that we're playing with. So there are copyright concerns somewhere that that should be circulating in the back of your mind. But they shouldn't be such a big problem that they're insurmountable. Because you will always be wanting to write these things differently in any case. So the core of the research is going to be the same, the core of the argument is going to be the same, but the way that you set it up to make it fit the different demands of article and book and PhD publishing will at least signal some sort of difference between the three. So I think that they get dragged apart really fairly naturally in that respect. And your second question?
Yeah, it's a very brief one actually. You talk about the scary thing about it takes 2 years to publish, when a PhD is 3 or 4 years. Of course, it depends on the journal and so on, and sometimes apparently they take like 2, 3, 4 months in very extreme cases. Is it like an exception that you mentioned, the 2 year period? Or is it,
In my experience, the 2 year period is now pretty much the norm. one of the reasons for that, I guess, is that the difference between the quick turnaround and the slow turnaround journals becomes in some way self-fulfilling, because the slow turnaround journals are the ones that are generally assumed to be the better ones. Yeah, so the ones that will take 2 years are likely to be the better ones. What happens when a journal gets a reputation as being a better one? It receives more submissions. What happens when it receives more submissions? It just slows the whole process down. Lots of journals now, lots of the very best journals now, even if you are get the formal acceptance letter today, they're booked up. They have things waiting in the queue to be published in print form for probably the next 15 or 18 months. But that's the difference between the best and the second tier journals.
It also perhaps depends on the area, like more like theory and political theory and philosophy and so on, and more contemporary research, because if you wait 3 years' time, maybe not out of date, but less relevant.
It makes it more difficult, I think, to write very contemporary things. You have to be able to find ways of justifying that sort of focus and what the contribution is going to be that extend beyond the claim that, well, it's in the news at the moment. Because it might be in the news at the moment, but as you say, it's unlikely to be in the news in a couple of years' time. So you have to be able to show the academic and the intellectual relevance of the work that you're doing that takes it beyond simply saying this is timely. So it needs to be timely in an academic sense rather than a following the news sense. But these are good issues about journal turnaround times and journal acceptance rates as well. What would your guess be about journal acceptance rates? What proportion of work that gets sent in do you think gets published?
You mean like sent in like for...
Yeah, that's submitted for submitted for potential review purposes.
15, 20%.
Anyone else?
15%.
It does, of course, depend on which journal it is. Some journals, and these might be some pretty good ones to try to identify and target for a start, will still have publication rates of about 40%. Most of the better ones will have no more than 10% though. So for every one piece of work that does get published, there are another 9 that have fallen by the wayside somewhere along the line.
How long would it take them to, if it's a rejection, to respond to you with a rejection so that you can actually go to another journal?
In general, they ask for reviewers to undertake the review in a 4-week period. And I think most reviewers do abide by that because they experience it from the other side as well as authors. And of course, you're always desperate to learn as an author as quickly as possible. So I think the quid pro quo, or whatever the phrase is there, is for you to pull your finger out when you're asked to review something and do it pretty quickly. But the editorial board will only be able to decide exactly what to do with the recommendations at their meetings. And the full editorial board might only convene once every 3 months. So it could be that all of your reviews come in very quickly the day before an editorial board meeting, in which case you might know within 6 weeks of having submitted it exactly what the decision is. If it comes in 2 days afterwards, though, there's another 3 months to add on top of that. So it just depends where you are in the cycle. And because nobody knows, it means that you can't have any useful expectation as to how long it will take. So it always comes as a surprise when you see in your inbox the email from the journal with decision, which is what they always do, though. Decision on manuscript number, whatever. So then you have to open it up and look.
And you're not allowed to submit it to different journals at the same time, right?
No, you're not allowed to do that. All of the online submission, it's a good point, all of the online submission tools now require you to declare that you haven't submitted it anywhere else. Some people, I think, possibly still try to do that, but you get yourself in a huge amount of trouble for doing it. This is how you destroy your own reputation even before you've started to build it. So don't do that. It sounds unfair in many ways. You might think that it would be nice if the journals could compete over your work. But unfortunately, that is a professional no-no.
Probably got time, I think, for maybe another one question. I don't know if there's anyone in the room after this. Maybe two, if we need it.
Well, I can keep going until 15:15, depending on whether Daz can be pacified and whether we get chucked out at 2:00.
When you get a desk reject, and I actually just got one. So obviously you don't have like a lot of like feedback. So what you could improve, is it then just the best strategy to basically target for like another journal with basically the same manuscript when you sort of convince that it's like sound, or would you suggest just like try like a major rewrite?
No rewrites. A desk reject tells you nothing at all. It tells you nothing at all except for the fact that you've read the aims of the journal, the intellectual aims of the journal, in a slightly different way to the editors. Okay. That's the only useful information you can take from that. So, no, if you were happy with the state of the work when you initially submitted it, nothing changed in that respect. Find another journal, get it into the house style, and send it off as quickly as possible. Okay. That would be my advice, sir.
How do you look at having publications in other English languages? How does it look on the CV? Is it just like something exotic, or?
There's a ref answer and an overall answer again, and a personal answer. And the personal answer, well, with me, it's just straight over my head because. I can only speak my own language, I'm afraid. The ref answer is that in previous REEs, all of the work that was submitted had to be work that was published in English. That's not the case anymore. So you can have non-English language publications that are submitted to ref, and rightly so. In broader terms, though, I think there's still a presumption when shortlisting committees meet, in this country anyway, I think there's still a presumption that they would prefer to see work published in English, English being the general international language of academia. So there's no reason why that necessarily has to be the case, but I think that's often the presumption. And one of the reasons behind that might once again be focused on journal impact factor ratings. One of the things that goes into the algorithm for those ratings is about how many times pieces of work are read and cited. If they're written in English, then they're likely to be read and cited much more often than if they're not written in English, given that, as I've just said, the international language of academia, for better or worse, is English. And given that the journal impact factor ratings are meant to be a sign of prestige in their own right, there's an inbuilt advantage for anything that is written in English in that respect. Roberta?
How do you feel about publications that's not in peer-reviewed journals? Should we still strive to have like policy briefs published or things like that, or is it
I think policy briefs and showing the connections with user communities, I think that's important. It's a different type of publication, of course, and you would write it in a different way. And one of the positive things in that respect is that it wouldn't be as though you were giving away your best academic arguments to be rewriting the implications of those arguments in a policy-relevant way. So I think that's an important activity, but almost a distinct activity from the one that I've been trying to discuss this afternoon. Where I would definitely go for peer-reviewed over non-peer-reviewed, though, is when it's the purely academic arguments that you're trying to make. I really would advise people, this might sound a curious way of phrasing it, and sorry if it does, but not to give away your best work for publications that are in non-peer-reviewed places. Keep your major intellectual insights, keep your best ideas for the peer-reviewed journal articles.
But related to this, you know, if you've got an idea, you feel like, well, it's not really like good enough. Is it like better to have it like somewhere, or just like, you know, it's not good enough, I don't want to have it anywhere?
Well, I would advise making the argument better as a way of resolving that. There's an interesting issue here, though. Economists have a wonderful conception of CV pollution. And they prefer to have stripped down CVs that maybe only detail the things that they published in what are considered to be top 10 or at the very outside, top 20 journals. And everything else they bury under the patio. They presume that it never existed. I don't think in politics, in international relations, that we have that same notion of CV pollution. I don't think we take the idea that there are objective rankings of journal hierarchies that seriously to be able to worry about things like CV pollution. But I'll go back to my first answer. If you've got the germ of an idea, I think it is better to wait to see how it evolves, to wait to see how much more flesh you can put on it, how much better you can make it, and then to maybe target what you would see as a proper publication rather than getting it out somewhere that you're not particularly interested in seeing it out, but you just want it to be published. I think it's probably better to take the slower build-up and to target something a bit grander. Any more questions there? Because nobody's tried to throw us out yet, and I have got another 10 minutes. Ian?
I have a question. You mentioned at the beginning the relationship between peer-reviewed journals and chapters in edited books. You know, if you go to a conference, for instance, you never know what's received in a book. If that's a well-placed book, for instance, and you think it's on a good series, for instance, would you think, what are the kind of relative merits of each and the few? Or does it just simply depend on the context?
Well, the book chapter, I think it depends whose book it is. If it enables you to show that you're keeping particularly impressive company, then there's nothing wrong with that at all. But I just think professionally these days, if you've been to a conference and you've organised panels and the panels have gone really well, that the incentive is to try to get a journal special issue published around the themes of that rather than a book. Some people do still go for the edited books, but it's difficult to make a case for a chapter in an edited book being as good intrinsically in career-building terms as an article in a journal. So if you do get involved in discussions after conferences and after conference panels about the relative merits of the two, do what you can to try to push the person who's organised the panel into trying to get a journal special issue out of it rather than an edited collection. More difficult for that person to organise, and it all again goes through the peer review process, but the reputational boost that all of you would get from being in that journal special issue I think is well worth the extra effort, especially if the extra effort is on someone else's part rather than yours. There's a number of processes. You would need to... I can just move forward, can't I? There we go. You need to get the people that you want to appear in the special issue to be on board for a start. And that would often mean acting as soon as possible after the conference has ended, while the positive experience that you all had of the panel is still fresh in everyone's mind. At that stage, it's often best to try to delegate the responsibilities to a fairly senior person, merely because journal editors, I think, being honest, would prefer to have approaches from senior people about editing special issues. Because there's a number of tasks there that the experience of having been in the profession for a while really does serve you in better stead to be able to fulfil successfully. But then it is just about trying to pitch it to the editors of the journal, trying to show them why this journal special issue would, one, fit the remit of the journal, two, would be read and read extensively, not only by its normal readers but maybe by other people as well, and three, what the value added to the journal would be of committing one of its issues in the next year or the year after that to this particular special issue. If you can do all of those three things successfully, journal editors are often very, very receptive, because if they've got four issues a year to fill and you're volunteering to fill one of them for them, that cuts their workload down a bit. So it's by no means impossible. Most journals now reserve probably one issue a year for special issues, and you see more and more of them all the time. And it's the sort of themed work that I think does add particular value to a journal's output.
Any more questions? No? Okay. Well, I was a little remiss in not formally introducing Matthew at the beginning, but I think it's probably better that you've heard more of his words than mine. That said, I'd like to take a moment to thank Matthew for coming along today to speak to us.
My pleasure.
I think you'll all agree that mere scholasticism is not really a term that we would apply to you, Matt, because unless we're talking about a scholarly tradition of going beyond sitting in an office and writing your work, you're a scholar in the true sense of the word, in terms of extending mentoring opportunities to people and to guiding us through the PhD process. And it's very generous of you to come along and do this kind of work in these professional socialisation sessions. So on that basis, can we please extend our thanks?